Welcome to Econ on Mics, where we dive into the world of research with insightful conversations featuring six remarkable women economists from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Proudly presented by the International Economic Association's Women in Leadership and Economics Initiative in collaboration with Women in Econ and Policy. Stay tuned as we uncover fresh perspectives and explore the global economic landscape.
Welcome to a new episode of the Econ on Mics podcast. My name is Maria Alzina Pujols, and I am an economics researcher at the ETH in Zurich. Today, I am very excited to introduce you to Professor Elisa Belfiori. Elisa is currently a professor at the Universitat Torquato di Tella School of Business in Argentina. She is a macroeconomist and obtained her PhD at the University of Minnesota in the United States. Since then, she has published several papers in leading international economic journals. Her research focuses on examining the optimal design of climate policies with emphasis on inequality issues, as well as applications from public finance. Her extensive academic expertise has awarded her several prizes. I was lucky to meet her some months ago when she was invited to give a seminar at my university in Switzerland. This allowed us to chat one-on-one, and apart from her research, I was deeply impressed by her determination to address real-world issues through her work and her ability to communicate research findings. I am very happy to have the opportunity to discuss some of your work with you today, Elisa, and share it with our audience. Just for the note, we are recording this on the 8th of March, so I wish you happy International Women's Day. Before we get into the specific questions, I would like to very briefly introduce the theme for today's episode. We will be focusing on Professor Belfiori's work that is concerned with issues around the implementation of climate policies in Argentina, in particular about the feasibility and challenges associated to different policy tools for that country specifically. And we will also touch upon her research on optimal policy implementation with heterogeneous regions, especially when regions differ in wealth and vulnerability to climate change. All right, so let's get into it. To get things started, could you maybe begin by giving listeners a little bit of context about emissions and resource use in Argentina?
Hello, Maria. So first of all, happy Women's Day to you too. I'm very happy to be here and this opportunity of chatting with you. So I moved back to Argentina in 2017 after 10 years of living in the US. So at the beginning, I was just focusing on my papers, and at some point I thought, well, if I'm going to be living in Argentina, I better know exactly what it means for a country like Argentina, or in particular for Latin American countries, to do climate policy and what is the role that we have to play. So I started studying that, and I published this paper on the economics of climate change, and we started building community here. With other researchers in environmental economics back in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and also in the countries in the region, in Uruguay. We have an agenda on development. And so policymakers are thinking about that and thinking about a lot of short-run problems. And so it's very hard to bring the climate agenda to the table, but each day is we are making progress in that direction. I think Argentina has done a lot of progress, in particular in measuring emissions, which I think is the first step. So we have actually a very detailed inventory of greenhouse gases that the government does. That allows us to measure emissions in production. Unlike the international, the European maybe, or the US emissions from Argentina come only half from energy use, and the other half is coming from agriculture and livestock practices. So that's a very,
I guess, it's a very important sector for the Argentinian economy, right?
Yes, it is very important and it is different. And so one, that was one of the things, first things that I learned when I came back to Argentina, that when we think about climate change and emissions, we usually go and think about energy. It's like there is a one-to-one connection. For countries like Argentina, it is true, like there is a big part that is the energy sector, and that is the hardest part. But then there is another part which has to do with agriculture and livestock. And that is also hard, but I think it's a better first stage to start working. We are closer to get into a clean economy in that sector, in agriculture, rather than in energy.
So you would say agriculture is the low-hanging fruit in Argentina?
I would say so. And so first of all, it's a sector that is very open. So it's an international, it works in the international market. And so it's very important to remain competitive. And so it's a sector that is open to innovation, and it's very innovative, and it's a prime line sector. It's world leader, actually, Argentina, in agriculture. And there are many sustainable farming techniques that were developed in Argentina. And so it's a sector that it's in the best interest of landowners and farmers to be sustainable, because that's a way to stay in international markets. And I've heard this from farmers. It's like, I want to be sustainable and take care of the land because that's my asset for my business. That, I think, is the main feature of a country like Argentina in terms of climate policy. If you want to start somewhere, I think the best way or the best place to start is agriculture. It's a country that is very dependent on gas. And that is something that is not easy to solve. The most exciting agenda, in my view, is related to the land and to agriculture.
I see. And also to gain a better insight on to this country in particular. So what is Argentina's current engagement in climate policies? Are there any carbon taxes in place? Is it being discussed? And if anything, needs to be changed and why?
Well, again, so Argentina is very volatile. So there's been periods of time in which we have made a lot of progress. There used to be a Ministry of Environment, which was very engaged in everything related to climate policy and environmental policies. And at that time, we had a tax reform in which we introduced a carbon tax. And it was introduced as a tax on fossil fuels. So we used to have a tax on fossil fuels, and we kind of transformed that into a carbon tax. And the tax rate is really low, so it's not really addressing carbon emissions in itself. But I think that the idea at that point, and we talk once in these workshops that I was talking about, that we meet every year once, we invited the person that introduced the carbon tax, and I was in charge of this policy reform. And he said, well, the idea was to just have the tax in the tax code. And that's a first step. Usually for countries like Argentina, and for many countries, it's like there is resistance on introducing new taxes to the tax code. And so once you have a tax code, if you can put that carbon tax, at least it's there, it exists. And then it's a matter of adjusting the rate to get it closer to the optimal level. So that was one of the reasons for introducing a carbon tax in Argentina. And the other one was thinking about climate policy as a trade policy, which was what I said at the beginning. For a country like Argentina that is so dependent on selling commodities and soy and also meet to international markets, it's important to remain competitive. And, there is this propagation of carbon tariffs right now. And so at that point, they were worried that this carbon tariff would keep us out the international markets. And so there was another reason just to show that there is commitment in the country for doing climate policy. So after that, then we have a lot of economic and political turmoils, and that always brings the climate agenda to a second level. And so that's, I think, is very particular from Argentina, but I guess for many of the other Latin American countries, that we are very into economic and social issues and political problems that we need to solve in the short run. And these are problems that we need to solve today. And so it always seems to policymakers that we can wait on climate policy, and that there are other countries that should be doing more, and they should do it first, and then we can follow later.
Indeed, yeah. So that sounds like there is definitely room for improvement in terms of climate action, but let's be honest, just like almost everywhere else in the world.
Exactly.
Now, I'm a bit curious about, so you have studied how regional inequality, not only wealth inequality, but also in terms of climate vulnerability, you've studied how this affects global climate policy. I'm curious to know about what motivated you to study this topic in particular.
Well, yeah, that's a nice question. And it's hard to answer because you never know where you get the motivation, right? Just it happens to me that I get into these problems. But I think there is a line in my research that has to do with equity. And it started with my PhD dissertation that I was focused on how do we design policies that take into account intergenerational equity. So just because it's a very intergenerational problem, climate change. So I think that was, I am an economist, and so I have my focus on efficiency and markets and but I also have like this second view of, okay, well, it's not always only about efficiency, but also there are winners and losers. And so my first question was, well, there are winners and losers intergenerationally, and what are we doing for the young people that are coming after us? And then that led me to an agenda, research agenda on intergenerational equity and climate policy, which now migrated into like within countries inequality, like within a country at the same time, like in the current generation, there is also like winners. There are winners and losers. And it happens to be that the losers are the low income households who spend a larger share of their income on goods that are polluting, like food and electricity and transportation. And so I have now a research agenda that is thinking about inequality, so income inequality within a generation. There is also this, I think it's a long, old question about equity across countries. Where there are countries that have developed and they have polluted the atmosphere, and now they are developed countries, but they have accumulated this carbon in the atmosphere, and we are all paying consequences. And so there are other low-income and developing countries that still need to develop, so they still need to do the same thing and pollute in order to develop, but now we cannot do that anymore. And so there is this idea of there is also a matter of equity across countries, which is very, very hard to solve. And I think it's at the heart of the problem, which I think it was another motivation of why. So I was thinking, well, the problem of climate change is easy. We should have a carbon tax and then it is solved. And then why can't we make progress on this? And then I realized, well, the problem is that it's not an economic problem. It's an inequality problem. The problem is that there are winners and losers, and they are like not even different people, different countries. And that coordination is the problem. It's not the externality in itself.
Indeed. So the intra and the intergenerational aspect is key for economies that study climate change. Now, could you very briefly maybe explain to us how does the optimal policy design differ among regions when there is climate inequality, either because there's inequality in climate-related output losses or because there's some uncertainty on climate shocks?
So one of my recent papers is entitled "Carbon Optimal Carbon Offsets with Heterogeneous Regions." And so in that paper, we start from this, again, this international coordination problem that somehow is being solved through these meetings. So we had the Paris Agreement, and then there are meetings every year. And so when we look at, okay, what did we agree on? Well, we didn't agree upon much in the Paris Agreement. It's like, oh yeah, we are all going to make an effort, but it's not clear like what is everybody. So, but the one thing that is clear is that, okay, there are some clear targets. And one of these is, okay, net zero by 2050. And actually, when I was in Zurich, so I was giving the seminar and someone told me, okay, well, the reason why we had this, he was in the negotiations during the Paris Agreement. And he told me, well, the reason we set a net zero by 2050 target is because it's easy to communicate. So it was like, okay, what can we agree on? Okay, let's agree on we need to cut emissions to zero, and then let's put a target net zero by 2050. So after that, we moved into, okay, country by country, how do we reach net zero by 2050? And so each country is supposed, we suppose that every country is working on reaching net zero by 2050. But then being in Argentina, like again, like going back to, okay, being a climate economist in Argentina and living the everyday life in this country, I was looking, so we have like bad news all the time, like the dollar, the inflation, and suddenly I look at Twitter and I get like a big tweet that says, oh, Argentina critically insufficient in the progress towards net zero by 2050. And it was in all red and like highlighted. And I said, okay, well, but I don't know. Is this what we are supposed to do? I mean, is it the optimal thing that Argentina should reach net zero by 2050? I think I can sign here like right now, say, okay, we are not going to be able to do it. I mean, we have so many on the table.
And that not only Argentina, most likely.
That doesn't mean that we are not committed. That doesn't mean that we don't want to do it. It's just that it's just not feasible. And so we work with my co-author, Manuel, who works also at De Tella University, on this policy design problem in which we have like countries that differ on income and on their vulnerability to climate change. And we say, okay, let's think about implementing a net zero target in this world, not in a representative Asian world, which everybody is the same and we are all like, no, let's think about a world that meets at the Paris Agreement. But in this world, we are different. We have like, just to keep it simple, low income countries and high income countries. And look for the best way to implement a global net zero target. And then we work out the policy design problem and we find that what it is optimal from a global perspective is to have high income countries to reach net negative emissions by 2050 and low income countries to reach net positive emissions by 2050. Which doesn't mean that low-income countries are not gonna or don't have to reduce emissions, but it's just they don't need to get to zero. They are allowed to, or it is optimal from a global perspective. Like if you could all agree on something, it is optimal for low-income countries to let low-income countries use the atmosphere for a while. Like let them keep polluting. And the way to reach the net zero at the global level is for rich countries to absorb carbon from the atmosphere. So if you want to think about it like we can think that we have this space in the atmosphere. This was all used up for only like 20% of countries in the world. And so there is a lot, big chunk of countries that haven't been able to use the atmosphere. And so what it is optimal to do from a global perspective is to tell, okay, you should clean up what you polluted so that these countries are able to develop and use that resource.
Which sounds pretty fair, actually.
It sounds like an equity statement.
Yes, and maybe this is also motivation for the whole world to engage in climate policies, which is something that we don't have yet, unfortunately. Now, in this work that you were explaining to us, in which you propose this carbon offset schedule, can you explain how it differs, implementing such a schedule, how this differs from simply direct transfers or redistribution of funds?
Yes, exactly. And that's actually like the heart of the paper too. It's like it's not a novel question. It's not a novel like insight that there are low-income countries and high-income countries, and that high-income countries are the responsible for polluting the atmosphere. And so the traditional and the old answer to this question was these climate funds, where there are these funds that are used to help low-income countries or developing countries to go through a green transition. The problem with these funds first is that, so that has been the traditional answer, like to have these cross-country transfers. The truth is, it didn't work. It's like the funds that have been channeled through these climate funds and green funds are too low. And it's not that, so we need much more money there. And the other, like if I think about a country that needs to transfer money to Argentina, I mean, I want to think about I'm in Switzerland or in Sweden. I say, okay, let's just transfer all this money to Argentina so that they can do some climate policy. It's very hard to monitor that. And it's very easy to end up in a situation in which you really don't trust that that's the best way to use your money. And so I think the advantage of thinking about, instead of just direct dollar transfers across countries, just to assign responsibility on absorbing carbon from the atmosphere, which, by the way, can be done technologically or can be done with natural resources like oceans, keep oceans clean, or forest preservation. So the advantage of thinking about that way is that each country can monitor what the country is doing in terms of that. I mean, if you do forest preservation, then you know how much carbon you are absorbing from the atmosphere. And maybe that is equivalent to transferring money to Argentina, but you don't have to do that. You just take care of what is... Mm-hmm. And it's your own responsibility. So I think it's it has an advantage in terms of this political, I think, the infeasibility of doing all this, of this transfer.
Indeed. So as a society, we need to think about the most effective policies, but also the feasible ones. And I think this is a contribution towards that goal.
I think about this role of carbon capture as equivalent to having a dollar value transfer mechanism. It's just that I think that one is not going to work and we are running out of time. And then instead of doing that, let's just do this, which is equivalent. It's not that I'm saying, oh, no, this is not a transfer of resources. It's still, it's just in a way, it's a transfer of natural resources. I am transferring room in the atmosphere to another country instead of transferring money.
So the two are equivalent in theory or on the paper, but the other one, but your suggested one is more feasible to implement in practice, let's say. Now, and to put that into context and to translate it into the real world, if the contributions of each country to global capture are conditional on wealth, what impact would this have on Argentina and other countries in South America or the global South more broadly?
Again, it's this intersection between the climate policy and development. So I also think that a country like Argentina or Latin America will not be able to stay in international markets with a production matrix very very high on carbon content. So I do think that countries will have to make a big effort in trying to clean their production and just have sustainable agricultural products and sustainable industry. But at least it's going to give the country some time to do that transition. I mean, I think it's 2030 is like a couple of years ago ahead, and then 2050 just around the corner as well. And so I think it's, you may think, okay, maybe we are going to, so we are going to lead to 2050 still polluting, and we maybe be net zero by 2080. So it's going to allow room for the countries to develop and to actually develop this green transition with a little bit more time. And it's going to be a tighter transition for the high income countries too. So it's not, I mean, it's not cheap for anybody.
Interesting. And are there any other striking findings or discoveries that you would like to highlight about your work?
So in this paper, we also calculate like how costly it is. Like because I mean, mm-hmm. I could say, okay, yeah, let's reach 2050 with negative emissions for high income countries. And now I don't have the number on my mind, but so it's not that costly. It's not infeasible when you look at how much does it mean in terms of GDP of the US or GDP of mm-hmm. European GDP. So the numbers it's a simple model. It's not meant to be a quantitative statement, but if we do a numerical examination of the results, it's something that actually is not that costly. I mean, in terms of, if you think about pandemics, if you think about climate shocks, I mean, these are things that potentially can have huge costs for the economy. And it seems when you look at the problem in itself and you try to calculate, okay, how costly it is to reach net zero by 2050 for some countries, or to reach net negative by 2050 for some countries. I mean, it's costly, but it's not infeasible. It's not like you say, okay, well, I have to give up 50% of my GDP. We also did a quantitative assessment, and it seems that, I mean, it's something doable.
Interesting. Now, we know that cross-country inequality is not the only dimension of inequality. There is also within-country inequality. And now, what would you say are the key considerations to take into account when designing climate policies in developing countries, particularly when there is a lot of within-country inequality?
Yeah, well, that's a big, that's another big area for research. And I think actually, all the macro climate agenda is moving into thinking about inequality in these models. Like, we have a first generation of models, which had a representative consumer, and I think we learned a lot from them, starting from Nordhaus and all the agenda that came after. But now, more and more, we are thinking that, okay, to really solve the problem, we need to address the inequality part of the problem. So that now I'm convinced it's not only like an externality problem, it's also an inequality problem. When we think about the optimal policy in a representative world or in a representative consumer world, the optimal thing to do is just to have an homogeneous carbon tax. And that is what it is. I mean, we should pay like for each carbon emission, we should pay all the same because the externality is global. But that is, again, only looking at the externality side of the problem. So I think we need to start thinking about climate optimal policy again if we are going to think about this not only as an externality, but also as an inequality problem. Because then, when you start going that way, people say, well, we don't want to solve world inequality doing climate policy, which is true. I mean, there is existing inequality that you don't want to solve it using a carbon tax. I mean, the carbon tax is meant to deal with climate change. But I do think that maybe we do want to solve the inequality that climate change itself generates. There is new inequality that arises from climate change. And so maybe, yes, it is a role for climate policy to do something about it. And then the policy design then is not obvious. It's no longer, oh, we should all pay the same. And so the first result, quick result that you are going to get is that you will want to have different taxes for different income levels. And that sounds like, it's at the beginning, you say, well, yeah, maybe it's obvious, but how can you do that? And I'm gonna tax like for the same thing, like using your car, I'm gonna tax more to high income people than it's kind of a. But there are other ways, like for example, I don't know, flying. I mean, you could pay a tax depending on how many flights you take per year, and maybe that's a way of doing it. So in a way, we need to think about making some redistribution through these carbon taxes and open up our mind that maybe it's not an homogeneous, like that idea, at least in my mind, is very like deep inside. I mean, we need an homogeneous carbon tax. And that I think is no longer true as long as you start thinking about inequality. And again, the old answer to within country inequality has been to think about transfers. Like, okay, yeah, let's put a homogeneous carbon tax and then we compensate low-income countries with low-income households with a lump sum transfer, which is, I mean, it's doable. I mean, it solved the problem. Somehow it's not what we observe happens, mm-hmm. right? So, so try to think about those questions again. I mean, how can we make this redistribution and these transfers work? Not in the usual way of just making lump sum transfers like all over the place. Of course, I mean, if you can get all the money from the rich and take it to the poor, then we solve the inequality, but that's not going to happen. So so we need to fine tune the design of the carbon tax. And
It's an important point and very controversial. I mean, on the one hand, we have the existing wealth inequality, but then climate change also generates inequality in itself. And then the policies to fight climate change, they also affect differently different groups of people. So it's an added dimension of inequality. So we should think of policies that take all that into account. And indeed, assuming a representative agent is very useful to have an idea of what is the cost of polluting globally. But indeed, when it comes to implementation of policies, we need to dig deeper on that and make sure we take all these details into account, because they are not innocent details. They are actually very relevant for everyday lives of people. And
I think we have done a poor job in communicating that the climate change itself mm-hmm. is an inequality problem. I mean, we have been so focused on this is an externality and we need a Pigouvian tax. Yep. I think we got that idea across, but then we are missing, which by the way, I mean, it's not that only climate change have that feature. Like many of the problems that we want to solve mm-hmm. in economics have like an efficiency part and an equity part. But in climate change is so like essential to the problem itself that you cannot think about it in isolation. I mean, you cannot say, okay, no, but I'm focused only on this part, because it's like then you are not solving the problem.
Now, there have been many debates about climate adaptation versus mitigation. Just as a reminder, adaptation refers to the process of adjusting to a changing climate, whereas mitigation refers to preventing or reducing the levels of climate change. Which would be the more optimal solution in the case of developing countries? What is your opinion?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I started studying this climate policy in Argentina for developing countries, it was like everything that I hear from policymakers that I talk to is, we cannot take care of mitigation. We have many issues going on. We need to develop, but all the efforts that we need to do has to go into adaptation. And I've been fighting that agenda from the beginning. It's like, that is true. Of course, we don't want to suffer from climate shocks and you need to be ready. And for the records, when if we have a big storm, like a couple of, I think it was last month, there was a big storm with strong winds. And trees fell down all over the city. And I think we had 1 week to just clean the city and keep it and it was only strong winds, you know? So we are far from ready and that to me is very alarming. We are far from ready to be able to cope with emergencies and with unexpected shocks or climate shocks. So I don't want to say, now we should not think about adaptation. I mean, we should. But I think, again, it goes one-to-one with mitigation, because I feel like if we don't make our part in cleaning our production, then eventually we are going to be out of market. And that is very costly for a country that is so far from everywhere, like Argentina, and that is where exports play a key role. So even when we need to be working on adaptation, we also need to just keep moving the mitigation part in terms of, and by that I mean just do either by a carbon tax or whatever, but we need to be working intensively in cleaning our production.
So again, for Argentina, the wheel of keeping up in the international competition could actually be an ally for climate policy.
Yes, I think for many countries, it's and that's why all the international now also negotiations are moving into this carbon tariff. It's we have still these kind of penalties that we can impose on countries. For some countries, I mean, I think for everybody, we all know the gains from trade, right? So it's very important to be able to be competitive. And I think we are moving into a world where if you don't take care of your carbon emissions in everything you do, in all activities that you do, then you eventually are not competitive anymore and you lose market power. Talking about the adaptation, as I was speaking, I was thinking about some of your work that, we can have governments investing in adaptation, but another part of adaptation is also private adaptation. And that holds for firms, try to protect themselves or their business. And for example, for the agricultural sector, they have all this insurance system to protect them from climate shocks. And then people also are developing this adaptation mechanism, which is, I should maybe move to countries that are less vulnerable or countries that where I will be more protected from climate shocks. And I know that you have done some research on this, which I think is a different type of adaptation, but equally important. I wonder if maybe you can share with the audience as well some of your work. I think it's very interesting.
Actually, it's very related to what we've been talking. Climate change doesn't affect all regions equally. And especially low and middle income countries are the ones expected to suffer more from climate change. For instance, through, as we mentioned as well, through more frequent and intense natural disasters. And because of that, we expect to see these potential flows of people being forced to move, to leave their houses behind, their countries behind because of climate change. I've looked at what are the consequences of these flows for the world society as a whole, but also for developed and developing countries separately. And basically what I find is that there are costs and benefits associated to this type of migration that are not equally distributed. Again, an equal distribution of climate impact. And what are these costs and benefits? Well, for instance, one clear benefit is that migration as a way to adapt will these people who have unfortunately been forced to move, but they will also suffer from less climate damages in the future. They will relocate to places that are less vulnerable to climate change. There's also the benefits of larger labor supply in the receiving countries, but higher labor force to produce. But there are also costs. There are the migration costs that climate refugees will have to face for migrating. And there are also congestion costs in the developing countries, in the receiving countries. So if we put all this together and we try to look at it from a global perspective, what we see is that from a global perspective, the costs and benefits, they more or less compensate each other. And because of that, this globally optimal carbon tax that didn't take into account countries act unilaterally, the global carbon tax would not change much if we took into account the effects of the consequences for climate refugees. Because costs and benefits don't affect all regions equally, if developed countries were to act selfishly, which is not an unreasonable assumption, so if they implemented carbon taxes just unilaterally, just taking into account their costs and benefits associated with forced migration, then what we see is that they should actually implement much higher taxes. So they will have higher incentives to fight climate change and to avoid this forced migration. So that's a bit of a summary of my findings.
All this, when we look at the problems with the economist's eye, we see all these like trade-off and cost and benefits. But I think there is also this side of all these problems, which is the political problem. And I guess for migrations is the social tension, right? Within countries that we are like, we've seen it. This is a historical thing. And that's none of that is present, right, in the model. Like, even if we can compensate cost and benefit, like from the economic perspective, then there might be all this social tension, like increasing, which is which may lead to other like economic costs. And and again, it makes all these problems so difficult to solve, right? I wonder if I'm sure you thought about these things.
Yeah, no, actually, and thanks for the comment, because it's true that this is not in the baseline results, but I do consider that in an extension. And what I find is actually, indeed, if we were to take into account all these potential political tensions because of originated for migration, then unilateral taxes in developed countries would be even higher. But then, of course, it depends on how large these tensions are. You know, if these tensions are relatively moderate, then the carbon tax would not increase much, it would just increase a little bit more. If the tensions are very much an issue, then we would reach a point in which developed countries would have strong incentives to fight climate change, just to avoid potential massive flows of climate forced migration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So the political aspect behind this, especially when we study migration, is also very relevant, because we see it in the electoral outcomes and in many high income countries. It's always in the political debate, like how should we deal with the migration issue. Well, unfortunately, time flies, and it's time, I guess, for us to conclude. But before that, I wanted to ask you one last thing. Do you have any recommendations for further reading on this topic?
Well, as I said, I think that now the agenda is into inequality and climate change, and there is a growing literature, people working on this. I think recently there was a paper like published, Climate in Climate Economics, and I think that's kind of a summary of where we are. Going back to my work on carbon offsets, I think that's another huge literature and area. Like if there are some listeners that want to write research ideas, I think carbon capture is going to play a key role. I mean, as we are running out of time, it's now we know that even if we all agree and we solve everything and like all the political problems that we were talking about, and we agreed to just cut emissions to zero right now, today, still it's not going to be soon enough. So we are going to like, because there are these synergies in the climate system. So the temperature is going to keep increasing, even if we just cut all emissions to zero. And so the only solution is going to be to just clean the atmosphere. And so maybe it's, as we are saying in the paper, like, high-income countries can do more of it and less of it, the low-income, or maybe all of us have to do it. And there are ways to do it naturally, which are also like a win-win, like forest preservation, like for Brazil and for countries like Argentina, that we have a lot of forest as well. And keeping oceans clean. I think all that area of carbon capture and biodiversity and keeping the system more than not only the economy but the system, the earth system working, is going to be very important.
Right. Well, I wish we could continue talking about these topics for much longer. But unfortunately, we have to draw this episode to an end now. But first of all, I'd like to thank you, Elisa, for taking the time to speak to us today and for sharing such interesting insights about some of your research. This is an amazing topic, and your research represents a great contribution to it.
Thank you for joining us. A special thanks to our brilliant speakers and interviewers for their valuable contributions. Share your favorite moments using the hashtag #AmplifyingVoices and stay tuned for more impactful discussions.